My name is David, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. Actually, I'd like to welcome anybody that is new, and thank those of you who have some time that are here. I am a recovered alcoholic. You know, the term alcoholic, if you look it up, is one who is addicted to alcohol. And I have recovered from the addiction to alcohol. I actually celebrated 20 years of sobriety this month. And thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's hard for me to tell my story without mixing it up sometimes. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is where I was raised. I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. But my story takes some twists and turns along the way, but I'm going to tell it just like it is, so that's just the way it is. And I got sober on October 2nd of 1989. I was 37 years old when I got here. And I was raised by alcoholics. That's just the way it was. My real father was and is an alcoholic. And my mother divorced him when I was about 4 or 5. And she, within a year and a half, something like that, she met a man in a bar selling Bibles. And she married him. And And for the next 8 years of my life, until my senior year in high school, we moved. We moved a lot, 26 times in 8 years. And sometimes to a different house, sometimes to a different city, sometimes to a different state. Just, you know, I'd get out from school and the car would be there and it'd be loaded up and we were on our way somewhere else. And everybody drank. There was a caravan of us, of uncles, two uncles, actually three of the adult males in that family. There were 18 children between the three families, and we hopscotched all over California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Texas, Oregon, Washington State. And we always met up here, there, everywhere. And so I had lots of cousins, some of them older than me, some of them younger. Many of those are dead now. Four of them are in prison. And that's just the way it was. There was always a gallon or two, because if one uncle liked a different kind of liquor than my stepfather did. But there was always a gallon on the kitchen counter. You know, sometimes 2 gallons, depending on who was living with us or who we were living with. And so there was always alcohol. And there was, you said I moved a lot. We did this thing, I was involved in a little bit of child labor. We had cousins and we were moving and there was always a need for money. And there were lots of boys in the family, so we were all put to work every time we landed in a new town. We were doing something. It was remodeling a house, digging up plants in the desert. My specialty was mechanic work. What it was like for me was, the best example is when I was 12 years old. My job was, I think I was in seventh grade, and my job was to come home after school, and there would be a car in the driveway, and I would jack it up, pull out the transmission, drag it down to wherever the shop part was, whether it was in the basement or in the garage, rebuild the transmitter, tear it apart, clean the parts. Then the next day when I got home, I would put the transmission back together and put it back in the car. I did 2 of those a week. And that's the way it was at 12 years old for me. And it stayed that way. Those skills have always come in handy in my disease because with that and other skills that I was taught, I was always able to stay self-employed and make a buck enough to drink in my adult life. But it caused a little bit of problems. I didn't get to do things in school. There were no after-school activities, no sports, no continuity with people. I learned not to talk to people, not to make friends, because there was no need to make friends. We were leaving anyway. And in my senior year of high school, we had landed back in Visalia. And it was about a month and a half before graduation, and they were moving again. And I was stubborn enough to go, I'm not moving again. And I hustled a place to stay, and stayed there, finished school, and signed up for this diesel mechanic manpower program to get my education to become a diesel mechanic. That was my dream in life. And I did that. And I completed that course. But during that time, that was in the summer, I graduated, started that school. And by November of that year, I met a couple guys in that school. And one of them was born here, but he was raised in Mexico. And the other one was born in Danube, and he was crazy. And so we spent the summer just being crazy. And in November of that year, the way things transpired for me is I was a heroin addict by then. And these people had introduced me to some new arenas of life. And I'd also met a girl along the way. Met her in a nut house. Went to visit her with a friend and fell in love. And November of that year, along with finding out, along with becoming a heroin addict, I also found out that I was that we were expecting our first child. And I did my best. At that point in time, not too long after that, I graduated that class and got a job and was working. And then I got an opportunity to do another job in landscaping, which I had become quite acquainted with as a kid, because one of my uncles was a landscaper. And like I said, we used to go out in the desert and dig up trees and plants and rocks and things. And in those days, you could do that and take them anywhere and sell them. And that's what we did. And but anyway, I got this opportunity to go to work for a nursery, and they were sending me to college. And I was working in the nursery, and then they would send me off to classes in college. I got to travel all over to arboretums all over the state. And but at the same time, I was young and still experimenting, and the lingering heroin thing was always there. And the reason that I went to that stuff, because I was never going to be an alcoholic like those people, like my parents. I was never going to be an alcoholic. And started smoking pot. The next thing I know, I'm a heroin addict, and that's the way life went. And I had that job, and this girl that I met in the nut house that had my baby was a heroin addict. And I was about a year and a half into this college thing and this nursery thing, and one day I came home from work, and she was walking out, and the car was all loaded, and she had my baby in her arms. And she just looked at me and said, "Where are you going?" She says, "David, you don't make enough money to pay the bills and keep me high, too." And off she went. And that was my first checkout time in life. That is when I gathered up what was left, sold it, and hooked up with my friend that was raised in Mexico, and that's where we went. And that began about a 9-year career in illicit activities that was just great. It was just great. Money, drugs, and everything I wanted. And learned how to fly airplanes, learned how to sail boats, drive speed boats, do all kinds of crazy things. And I'd like to glamorize that, but it was fun for a while. And the truth is the way that happened is I was, I came back to California. I was driving a load to California, and I dropped it off, and I left instructions on what to do with it, and they didn't do my instructions, and they passed it around, sold it to some people, and somebody died. And I couldn't do it anymore. I knew the person that died. and I just couldn't do it anymore. So I quit. I never went back to Mexico again. Only thing was, is that through all these years of doing what I was doing, is that I was, I had a pretty good little habit going. I had things going on with me, you know, and I quit, but this time I still had the money. And I lingered. I still had connections and all that good stuff. And I went and got a job, and by the time I had met someone new with three little kids, and I had my daughter, and so we had four kids, and we got a place, and we got the horses and the chickens and the cows and all the stuff that you do when you have kids. You know, all the little league stuff started up and all that. And I'm trying to work this job, and I have this lingering thing going on with me, you know, my addictions. And in a short period of time, I was using more than I was making again. And that marriage ended. And lasted about 7-8 years, and then it ended. Me and my daughter were living here in town, and I was hopeless and helpless, drinking and using. And I lived next door to this lady, God bless her, that had some experience with Alcoholics Anonymous, and had watched me long enough to know that I had a problem. And so she offered to, in 1980, she offered to take care of my daughter for me if I would go into this recovery home and try and get sober. And I took her up on that deal, because I OD'd like three times in the last month, and things were getting pretty ugly. And so I went into Pine Manor at that time. It's called Pine Manor. And stayed there for about 18 days, something like that. And I was in a class. Frank Ross was teaching it. And somebody asked Frank if they'd ever seen anybody get sober without God. And Frank said no. And I was bunking the same room with this criminal. And the whole house was full of criminal types, I thought. You know, I didn't put myself in their position, you know. So I decided that I should go somewhere where God lived, because he certainly wasn't in this place with these people. Yeah, it was the perfect excuse to sneak down out the back door and I don't know, lasted probably 30, 40 days and got drunk again, and that's the way it was. And a few years went by. I was experimenting with, I was looking for God, so I had started attending churches and stuff while I was drinking, and just, you know, trying to find something. And what I found was another woman to marry. Yeah. And that's a story in itself. A sweet, sweet, loving person. And her and I, over the next 5 years, had two children together. But our marriage did not last 5 years. We were married about a year. We had one child, my son Robert. And I was drinking. By this time I was drinking. That had become the mainstay. I could get that on any corner, and it was cheaper than anything else. And so I only did the other stuff on special occasions. Yeah. But I drank every day. I never drank. And when I talk about all those years prior to that, about, you know, my addictions, alcohol was always there. It was just the chaser for everything else. Yeah, but at this time I was drinking again and making her life just absolutely miserable. I had a wonderful, wonderful job, best job I'd ever had in my house, in my life, for this company, and it was a good job that paid me well. But I was drinking, and the marriage fell apart. And I had a son with her. And that year, actually, while we were getting our divorce, we had bought a house east of town here, and she had left. I thought I was supposed to leave the house, because that was the beginning of court orders and restraining orders and things like that. Yeah, she actually hired somebody that knew what to do. But I was one day leaving that job that I had, that wonderful job I had, and she had taken the car, and I had the motorcycle. So I left the job, and I stopped to Larry, and I got myself a bottle. You can't drink while you drive a motorcycle, so I just drank the bottle like I always did. I always drank the bottle when I bought it. There was no reason to sip on a bottle. So I drank that bottle, and I was coming east of town here, and I was actually had enough money in my pocket to do those other things that I like to do. But things weren't happening fast enough for me. I wasn't feeling good enough yet, and so I stopped at this other place and grabbed another bottle and drank that, of course, and then got on my motorcycle to go do my other fun stuff. And got outside of town and had a terrible, terrible wreck. Just a terrible wreck. So down there killed me. And so I'm... my only resolve, of course, was to, where do I wind up? Back at Mom and Dad's. Well, I got out of the hospital, and I'm laying on Mom's couch, and it was like an 8-month process to get my legs back together and all that good stuff. And I had pills, yeah. And then I got good enough and strong enough to where I could actually hobble the half mile to the liquor store. Yeah. And then I could just lay on that couch forever. Yeah. And somewhere in the next 2 years, I went back to town in Springville, where my children were raised, and worked my way. One day, just one day, one time, back into this lovely woman's life, and we conceived another child. Yeah. And so now I have a daughter. So I have a son and a daughter with her. Of course, the next day I showed up drunk, and so that wonderful dream was over again. And I was up getting around again, able to work a little bit, and my dad always found a way to keep me busy, make me a few bucks, and this and that. But I was crazy, and I was a drunk. And the kind of drunk I was is every once in a while, like my dad would say, he says, David, you're a real nice guy. He says, and when you just drink a half pint, you're fine. He says, but every once in a while, might be a month, might be 2 months, might be 3 months, might be 6 months. He says, just ever so often, it's like a bomb goes off around here. Yeah. And we never know what to expect. And that was while he had asked me, he was explaining that to me, as one day he asked me if I'd go for a ride with him. And I said, sure. So we went for the ride, and he was explaining all this stuff to me, and I'm wondering what the hell he's talking to me about this shit for. And he's driving off past the Larry there. And then all of a sudden he stopped at this stop sign, and he says, David, he says, this is where you have to get out. Yeah. That's my dad. That's the man that raised me. Yeah. This is where you have to get out, David. And you're not welcome back home anymore. Yeah. I can't have you doing that to my wife. And luckily, I had one of those drunken uncles that we used to run around with. And I'm sure that was kind of in the back of my dad's, in his mind. That within about 4 or 5 miles, Uncle Gene lived right there. And he was drunk also. And so we made a great pair for a while. And shortly after that, well, actually, actually, just prior to me getting in that motorcycle accident, the marriage ended, is I had married her, and I was drinking, and so the family got together, and they suggested that I go get sober. So they hooked me up with a Christian recovery center called Teen Challenge. And that was my true second attempt at long-term sobriety, because I checked myself in there, and I stayed for 6 months. And we studied the Bible every day, and sang in churches, and it was just wonderful. And I had gotten out of there, and again, within 2 or 3 months, I was drunk. You know? And that's why that marriage ended. You know, that one more try, she was going to, chance she was going to get me, and it just wasn't happening. And so here I am with my Uncle Gene Cook. We're both drunks. And that didn't last long because two drunks can't usually live in the same house and all the shenanigans that go on. And plus, he didn't like my other habits. I pretty much wound up, that would be like 86, something like that. I got sober in 89. And I pretty much, from that point on, found that it was, I'd hooked up with this. I worked, one of the other things that I was taught to do when I was a kid was work on wash machines and dryers and refrigerators. And so I hustled up this little vehicle and I went out to these furniture stores, and I could always make a buck doing that. And I landed up, for some reason, I call it God now, but I was at this furniture store east of town here. And I walked in and introduced myself and told the old man there that, you know, I worked on appliances and stuff. And his name was Art. And Art hired me. And, of course, Art didn't have much money either. But he hired me and let me work there. And I was staying in this abandoned house in Tulare. And finally he figured out something was going on, because I just, you know, didn't always have, you know, I wasn't always clean or anything. And so he says, well, why don't you just come and you can stay in the store here, you know, and that way you don't have to drive. And he knew I didn't have a driver's license. By then I had lost my driver's license. And so I did. And he had this little shed out back of his place there that was comfortable there too. And by the time I had also gotten quite comfortable with just about anywhere, alfalfa fields were good, and they were soft. Bridges worked, because you get down underneath the bridge and the wind cuts the wind. And I was quite content to live that way. I actually believed by that time in my life I deserved to live that way. And so I worked out there, and Art Ward figured out that I couldn't handle money. Anytime I worked and I made money, I would disappear. Yeah, I'd disappear. So Art Ward was an old, retired Nazarene minister. And Art Ward says, well, why don't I keep your money, and I'll just give you a little bit every day to spend, and that way we can get some of these fines paid off before you go to jail again. But I was always going to jail. I thought jail was actually a vacation by then also. It was a time to get some rest, some food, and pay fines. I could pay my fines by going to jail. It was great. And I lived there for the next 3 years and stole from that man and lied to him and used him and continued my addictions. And that is where I was left. About 4 or 5 years where I found the true meaning of being an alcoholic, one who was addicted to alcohol. Because by then it wasn't a choice whether I was going to drink. It was David was going to drink, and he had to drink. And Art Ward knew that, so he would always give me enough money in the morning, $5, would buy me a half pint and a pack of cigarettes. He'd walk in the door, give me my $5, I'd go down and get my stuff, he'd do the same thing at lunchtime. And then at dinner time, before he closed the store, because I didn't have, by then my vehicle had gotten broken, he'd give me $10 so I could buy dinner. Yeah. But I bought a pack of cigarettes and a pint. Yeah. And it actually got to the point that at that liquor store, after that long period of time of buying my booze there. Of course, I had bank credits there and everything else. But the man that owned the store that would work there at night realized that I was dying, and he would no longer sell me my pint and my cigarettes by themselves. He gave me every night a TV dinner, so I would eat something. And it was at Art Ward's place in 1989 that things came to a head, and I was quite literally trying to kill myself. And one night I stole a bunch of stuff from him, and I stole his truck, and I went to the places I knew. I bought a fifth of what I liked, and I went and bought all of the other stuff I liked, and I figured I would just take care of it. And I went to where I got there, and I don't know how I wound up where I wound up the next day. And I woke up out at Cutler Park. They were mowing the lawn. I was about to get run over. And because I had mowed that lawn many times. And I looked up, and there was his truck. And I knew the guy in that ran the place. So I got up, and I went over to the shed, and I used your phone. Screw David. And I called Art, and I told him, I've got your truck. And he says, Where are you? I told him. And part of the story is I'd been trying to get my driver's license back while I was with Art. So I was going to this drunk driving school where I met this man, Jerry D. And Jerry D, 2 weeks prior to that, I had hit one of my bottoms, and Jerry D had one more time said, David, if you're tired enough yet, I've got a place I can get you into that will help you. And with that day, I accepted. And I told him, okay. And so I was on the waiting list at Pine Recovery. It was Pine Recovery by that time. And that day that I stole Art's truck and sold his furniture and sold it for my fun and called him, he says, don't go anywhere, I'll be right there. And by that time, I didn't care. I figured jail was as good as any place else. And Art Ward showed up, and he came out just smiling and happy. I can see him that today. I can see him walking down this little embankment at Cutler Park, and I'm sitting by this tree. And he's just saying, David, you'll never believe it. You'll never believe it. And I said, what? And he says, you know that place you've been trying to get into? He says, they just called. And I said, well, we'll have to go by the store and get my clothes. He says, oh, no, I've got them. And that got me to Pine Recovery one more time in October 2nd of 1989. I was gifted with the gift of desperation one more time. And I remember on the questionnaire when I was going in there, them saying, on there was a question, are you willing to do it our way? And I remember balking at that. That's the only question I remember from the thing, and I remember stopping and reading it a couple of times and making a decision. And I made a decision at that point in time. I would do everything I could the way that they asked me to do it, because other than that, my only desire was to die. And so I did. That began my journey in 1989. And I did to the best of my ability everything that they asked me to do. My ability at that time in my life was pretty twisted. All those things they tell you, do this, don't do that, no relationships the first year, all the stuff that suggestions people will give you. I went to all the meetings they asked me to do. I read the book to the best of my ability because I could not read well at that point in time. By that point in time, I had also become a social inept. So I just could not sit in a room with people and talk, have a conversation with people. My first experience with I always hid in meetings, in the back, in the dark, or big meetings, so I wouldn't have to talk. And then they asked me one time to pick a home group. And down at St. Paul's, we used to have this meeting. I think it was on Thursdays. And it was a big, big meeting. So that's me. Yeah, that's my home group. I can get away in there. And I'll be darned if within like 2 weeks after I wrote down on my little paper that's my home group, they decided I had a group conscience in that group and decided to break the whole meeting up into tables of 10 so everybody could share. Yeah. And that's quite literally how the first time I ever spoke in a meeting was around that little table. I did the best that I could. You know, like I said, when I got here, my thinking was pretty twisted and out of alignment with anything that was a positive of good nature. And I studied as much as I could. I got into that relationship at 90 days. You know, I wanted this girl that had a year that 13 stepped me. And we got into a relationship. That was my first marriage in Alcoholics Anonymous. We got married and we stayed together for 5 years. I remember when they found out, number one, I was in a recovery home, not supposed to get into a relationship. So I was about to get thrown out of that recovery home. And number two, she had a sponsor. And her sponsor didn't go to her. Her sponsor came to me and nailed me and said, "Hey, yeah. You're going to be in this relationship. This is what you got to do." And she made a list of things that I had to do and that we had to do. And we did those things that she asked us to do, and we worked this program to the best of our ability. And we got married, and we lived together for 5 years. And I can say that at the end of 5 years, we both had grown enough to realize that we didn't even know who we had married. Yeah. And at 5 years, you know, I was a totally different person than I was when I got here. And so was she. But we both stayed sober. We got our divorce. And we're friends now. And everything is good. This program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got about 3-4 minutes. And I spent most of it on how I got here. And this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I got here, and in the process of the years, 5, 10 years, 15 years, there have been incremental stages of growth and awareness. You know, when I got here, it was all about putting in my cigarette pack a little note that said, "Don't lie today, David." Because I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief, and I couldn't help it. But if I pulled out that cigarette pack, it would remind me, "Don't lie today." You know, if someone left the cigarette pack in front of me, because I was poor, they were out of luck. Yeah. Oh, well, they shouldn't have done that. Yeah. But slowly, I learned not to do that stuff. You know, and slowly, as the more gross things, those kind of blatant things fell by the wayside, I began to learn the more intricate and personal things about lying, cheating, and thieving. You know, manipulating people, feelings, emotions, love, trying to hustle God. That's a tough lesson to learn. Yeah. Trying to hustle God. Because I did that for a long time sober. Making deals. Thinking that if I did this, God was going to do this. At 5 years when I got that divorce, I was just devastated. I could not believe that God would do that to me. I had gone to meetings constantly. I had worked the steps. I had done everything this program asked me to do. I worked a job. I worked hard. And my world was falling apart. And how could God or Alcoholics Anonymous be true? How could this be the way it is? I did not drink, no matter what. Wife, no wife. Job, no job. Good health, bad health. Money, no money. No matter what, I did not drink. I did not drink by going to meetings, even in the bad times, like crying in meetings, hobbling in there when I was in accidents and stuff. But I think more importantly, that by being here and having a little bit of longevity in here and getting to know people, there were people that saved my life that I had, was not even friends with, but they had watched me. And when the crisis happened one time, when I was going through that divorce, I was in a meeting. I was crying. And I was devastated. And this man that I didn't know very much, I'd seen him in meetings and stuff, but I had walked out of the house with my paper bag in my car and spent the night at my sponsor's, and I went to the morning meeting, and I was sharing what was going on. And he just walked by, and he threw this key in front of me. It had a little tag on it with the address on it, and he says, "Take the second door down the hallway." And so I had a home. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works. If you're willing to ask and you're willing to go, share with people, let people know what's going on in your life. No one can offer you their experience, strength, and hope unless you are willing to put your circumstances on the table. Now, I'm not saying in all situations you go to an open meeting and just blurt out what's going on. But you can get, if you go to meetings, you can pick, and you'll begin to know when the right opportunity is and when the right time is to present your situation. And God will present the solution. That's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't drink no matter what. Go to meetings, read the book, practice the principles to the best of your ability. When you screw up, you get to do it again. You need to practice this program. I have not mastered it yet. And so, I'm still a liar, a cheat, and a thief, but I'm much better at it. I am much better at it, and as I said, the intensity of it is far less. And I can catch myself, and the program gives me the ability to right those wrongs as I go. If you're new here, and you're trying to figure out why you are here, it is not because you are addicted to alcohol if you're not drinking and you have not drank for a period of time. It is because you suffer from the disease of alcoholism. The solution to the ism is in the steps of this program, in the fellowship, in creating and finding that higher power. And I pray that you all do. My life, today, 20 years later, I look back, that daughter that was born, and I had a restraining order. I got to see her for like an hour when she was born, and then an hour 4 months old, and for the next 4 years, I didn't get to see her. I couldn't go to that town. And she lives with me now. Dang it. Yeah. Anyway, if you're new, give yourself a break. You don't have to live that way. Yeah, and then this agrees with the progressiveness of this, and so is the progressiveness of recovery. I have found so much about myself and so much about a higher power and so much about people around me, how to love, how to be loved. I truly hope that you stay and that you actually gather the information and the relationships that you need to be able to sustain life on life's terms, because sometimes it'll just kick you in the ass. But it's doable here. Only place I have found. That's all I got.